The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Selena, this much dreaded second wave is really materializing. Where are we seeing these new hotspots?
Right, Heidi, even though America's overall case count has been slowing, rising just under 1% this week, there's a big concern around these localized surges. So we're seeing rising COVID cases in 22 states. For instance, Texas on Wednesday reported about 2,500 new cases. That's the highest one-day total ever. And a month into its reopening, Florida this week reporting about 8,500 new cases. That's the most of any seven-day period. And in California, you're seeing hospitalizations at their highest since May 13th. And Arizona's daily tally has also spiked very abruptly in the past 2 weeks.
You know, we're not thinking about raising rates. We're not even thinking about raising rates. So what we're thinking about is providing support for this economy. We do think this is going to take some time. I think most forecasters believe that. It would be great if we got a whole bunch more months of job creation like that. Notwithstanding that, as I mentioned, there are just a lot of people that are unemployed, and it seems quite likely that there'll be a significant group at the end of even after a lot of strong job growth that'll still be struggling to find jobs, and we'll still be providing strong accommodation for that.
In the beginning, it was about the sequential improvement, and markets got reinforcement of sequentially improving situation on health and therefore on the economy, and markets got carried away. So now the implicit valuation is that not only will the journey be a pleasant one, but you're also certain about the destination. And what we've been getting over the last couple of days are legitimate questions, both about the journey and the destination. What we haven't been getting is any question mark about central bank support that is consistent and strong, nor really about market fundamentals, market technicals. You see it again today. The buy the dip mentality, the conditioning to buy the dip is very deeply embedded in this market.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Major indexes plunged this week after a jump in unemployment claims spiked in the latest reporting period. Markets also worried over a spike in COVID cases as a result of protesting, with no social distancing being practiced, and the reopening of economies. Major indexes are poised to close down about 3.5% for the week, breaking a three-week winning streak. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplav, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Tom McClellan will join me this week as my technician. He sees this week's pullback as a correction, with markets expected to head higher as the Fed continues to pump liquidity into the markets. He also sees rising interest rates accompanying rising oil prices. Also on the program today, Mark Chandler will join me. Mark believes the dollar has peaked with Fed QE and physical largesse, which could be bullish for commodities. And Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will also bring you another update on the economy and markets with this week's Smart Macro. But first, let's sum up what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. You know, the news this week in the financial market was the financial market itself. There was no big catalyst that caused investors to rethink trading strategies except for valuations and maybe year-to-date performance for the stock market. On Monday at the close, the S&P 500 had wiped out all losses for the year, and the Nasdaq stood at a 10.6% gain. Even before the Federal Reserve spoke and gave a sobering assessment of the economy Wednesday, we began to see a rotation out of these cyclical stocks and back into defensive areas. Now, the dot plot from the Federal Reserve Wednesday cemented the idea that the U.S. stock market had moved too far and too fast. I think at one point on Thursday, Elon Musk had tweeted LOL. And when he tweeted again what that meant, he said stonks, which is it seems to be an internet meme going around now about stock valuations. You know, the stock market fell this week, even on news that Moderna's vaccine will enter phase 3 trials in July and include a study of 30,000 subjects. News like that had positively helped catapult the market higher in the past. But on the same day of Moderna's announcement, that was Thursday, the S&P 500 dropped 5.9%. The Dow Industrial fell 6.9%. And the Nasdaq Composite fell 5.3%. You know, it was no surprise that the market was due for a pullback. I think it was really the ferociousness of the decline that did surprise many. Yet it wasn't a crash. If you were watching the minute-to-minute chart like I was, it was a slow and steady process, as if funds and investors sent their large orders down to the order desks for algorithms to break up the trade into smaller trades for the whole day. There was no rally, just a slow drip on the bid without a buyer in sight. Now, I'd like to talk about some of the technical setups here this week because I think those were really more newsy than any company announcement or COVID-19 development or political underpinning. Though COVID-19 development, and my brother Chris sent me a chart through the week, I think on Thursday, actually it was an infographic showing the United States of America with little small charts, either red or green per state, and the trend for what testing was doing in COVID-19. And the majority of states continue to have an increase in positive tests for COVID-19, and that's not a good thing. But before I do go into some of those technical setups, I want to talk about the Federal Reserve's announcement this week. There was no significant changes to policy. The two big changes were mainly in language, and that was the announcement that they'll continue to buy treasuries as well as agency residential and commercial mortgage-backed securities at a current pace. So that changed versus as needed. And they noted financial conditions have improved. That was a difference in the policy statement this go around. During the conference, Powell said that the Fed is discussing more explicit language for its guidance and asset purchases, which have been mainly, more broad based in what they're doing. We're continuing to purchase or we're increasing purchases. Nothing more explicit telling us how much or for how long. So he also said that they're nowhere near talking about raising interest rates. So basically stop asking him. Sees many differences with our current conditions versus the Great Depression. And there's been a lot of inferences that we're currently in the next Great Depression, which I've talked about in previous statements what that is. It's a very long period of time of negative decline in GDP or greater than 10% deceleration in the economy. Recovery, he said, will take time and full recovery only when the consumer is confident. Now let's talk about the dot plot. The dot plot showed major changes because I don't believe there was an April one. I went back to the Federal Reserve calendars page to look and see if they did one. I don't think they did. I think a lot of people look at a lot of companies. They weren't even giving any kind of guidance in if they were announcing in April during the first quarter earnings. So a large change from December. Here is some of those comparisons. GDP is projected to be down 6.5% for this year versus up 2.2% was what they were projecting back in December. Unemployment at 9.3% versus 3.5% from that, again, that December comparison and projection. And inflation only up 0.8% versus inflation up 1.9%. So some real big changes there. And the biggest one is the Fed sees low interest rates for the Fed funds rate near zero for going out to the end of 2022 versus the end of this year. So those signals helped continue to see the 10-year yield decline, which dropped all the way down to 0.74% on Wednesday and then down to 0.65% at the close on Thursday after the drop in stocks. All right, let's talk about those technical conditions because I really wanted to focus on this and it shows some explanation why there was a correction. Maybe not so much the severity of, down 6% on Thursday, but here, let's just jump in here. In our internal meetings, I've been talking about this a lot to our investment committee, but I apologize to you, our listeners, that I didn't bring up some of these topics, which I think would have been more timely last Friday when I gave the wrap up. So I highlighted in our review that the percentage of stocks above the 50-day moving average was near 95% last week when we met on Monday, and then this week when we met again on Monday to really take a look at some of these things. Anything above 70% is overbought. Again, we were at 95% of the S&P were above their 50-day respective moving average. That's very elevated compared to years we've seen on that indicator. Secondly, I was taking a look at the CBOE's equity option ratios of puts to calls. And I look at this one particularly because you tend to see smaller retail investors utilize equity options versus index options, which is typically used in large hedgers. And so I take a look at the difference between those two different ratios to get an idea of greed or fear versus more smart strategical hedging. And then what that showed is that the put-to-call ratio was at the lowest levels I have seen in years for the CBOE equity option ratio. Again, showing outright greed and possibly complacency given where fundamentals are. The volatility index, the VIX, is another indication of kind of that put-to-call ratio and what's going on there. Hedging activity was never really jumping in previous dips in the S&P all throughout this recovery. We've seen 4 to 5% dips around, I believe, like three or four of them. But every time, the volatility index never broke its downtrend that began in late March. This time it did, this week, jumping up incredibly up to, I think, the 40 range. So a big jump there in the volatility index, clearly identifying that people were reducing risk and hedging. So this week, in talking with Chris and reviewing our strategy on the portfolios, Chris Poplava, we are basically neutral right now in our posture towards our relative benchmarks. So for example, a growth portfolio would typically have 80% in stocks and 20% in bonds. We're about there, but our precious metals somewhat skews that in our favor. We don't anticipate a deep correction here due to positioning, but investors and flow data that depicts high cash positions basically tells us, you know, that we don't think there's going to be a major correction here. Just some sideways trading, maybe a sideways consolidation. I was anticipating anywhere between a 5 and maybe 15% dip at the most. Maybe that is helpful to you, the listener. Let me give you an idea of what would give us a reason to be at our maximum risk levels, which could take maybe a growth portfolio to 100% in stocks. What would it take to get? And I've been highlighting some of those catalysts in previous wrap-ups, so let's just do that here. It's mainly at this point, we want to see a vaccine. We want to see a recovery in consumer confidence. We want to see a drop-off of COVID-19. And economic expansion in the economic indicators. It was nice to see the unemployment drop down at the May report. The Fed also said that was a pleasant surprise, but we'd like to see that obviously drastically lower. A small laundry list, but one that hasn't developed yet, and I hope that helps, but I believe Chris Poplava will get into more of the weeds of what we're looking at with Chris Sheridan for the big picture this week. But before they do, let's get back to Jim with McClellan for more in-depth technical analysis on the markets.
Real interest rates cannot go significantly higher because then basically every government around the world would be bankrupt. Many companies would be bankrupt and the whole private sector would have problems. So we just cannot afford significantly higher real rates. And that's probably the main case for gold, because we're running out of safe havens. We're having now 14 trillion in bonds trading at negative yields. So as soon as inflation becomes a concern, there will be massive outflows from those bonds. It is always gold that goes first, then silver is following, and we're seeing that now. And then the third stage is commodity markets in general.
To hear this full interview with Ron Stoferle, where we discuss his latest In Gold We Trust report, where he provides his outlook for gold, silver, precious metal stocks, and many other areas, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Just when you thought volatility had left the stock market, we are doing this interview on a Thursday. Currently, the Dow is down about 1,500 points, reacting to an increase in unemployment claims. Where's the market going from here? Is this a correction? What's going to happen going forward? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. Tom, let's begin with the market. The day you and I were doing this on a Thursday, currently as we speak, the industrials are down about 1,500 points. The NASDAQ, after reaching a record, it is down. And we have the S&P down almost 150 points. So take it from the top. What's going on here?
Well, when we bottomed March 23rd, the market shot up and stumbled a little bit, and then has had a nice, rather smooth uptrend since that stumble. So this is the first stumble since end of March, and it's a normal thing in an uptrend. The most important factor is still the fact that the Fed is throwing everything it can at the financial system. It's printing money like crazy. Whether that's a good idea or not is certainly a discussion we can have, but it's for sure a bullish idea, and it's going to work, because we learned pretty well in QE 1, 2, and 3 that when the Fed is doing QE, the market goes up, and when the Fed stops, it's very unpleasant for those who stay too long at the party. But the Fed is showing no signs of stopping. On Wednesday, the 10th of June, Chairman Powell had a post-FOMC meeting, press conference, and said that they are going to continue this for a long time. They're going to keep rates low. They're not thinking about raising rates. They're not even thinking about raising rates. And they're going to continue the QE for the foreseeable future. So we can have these pullbacks that come along from time to time, but it's still a big uptrend.
We're going to make available to listeners, you've sent us a couple charts that you think are significant. Let's begin to talk about them. And if you're listening to this program, just go to the website and you can see the charts we're talking about. The first one is the S&P 500. You've got the QE1, QE2, QE3, and I don't know what you call the current one, QE NASA space launch and the election. But let's begin with that. And what's the significance of this chart?
This is looking at total treasury debt and mortgage-backed securities, or MBS, that are held by the Fed. Some people will tell you should look at the Fed's total balance sheet, but the total balance sheet includes these two plus some currency swaps and some other things that don't seem to matter as much for the stock market. These two holdings of the Fed and how they invest in the banking system by buying these things seem to be what matter for the stock market. And yes, we're seeing QE at a rate that's never been seen before. And it's working. It's helping to lift the stock market. They started out slowly back in 2019 because they were noticing some imbalances. And so they wanted to try to help the banking system a little bit. And we were instructed at the time to not call it QE. Powell said, oh, don't think of this as QE. It's not QE. They stopped saying that. They're doing QE 4 now, and they're doing it at a rapid rate. And it's working. Today, the pullback notwithstanding.
Well, the amazing thing about this QE, Tom, they did the last QE, QE3, I think they did $1.6 trillion, and that was over, what, about a year and a half. This is QE4. They did $2 trillion in just 2 months.
Yep, trillion a month. That's just an amazing thing.
And so as long as they're doing this, what we've learned, at least as your chart shows, if you look at the QE, every time they launched QE, the market always headed higher. And the biggest run-up was QE3, and now we've got QE, like I said, QE NASA space launch. Let's go to your next chart, which
Before
is the...
Before you do that, Jim, hold on a second. You said the important thing. While the Fed is doing QE, it's good for the stock market. The other part of that statement is, as soon as they stop, it's bad for the stock market. Then at the end of QE 1 and 2, they stop suddenly. QE1 stopped and we got the flash crash in May 2010. QE2 stopped suddenly and we got a 19% decline in July of 2011. They learned their lesson from that and they stopped QE3 more slowly. They tapered, but we still had some ugliness and some volatility in 2015 and 2016. So you can't get away from it, no matter what the Fed does to try to taper and slow it down. At the point when they turn off the spigot, this is going to get ugly. But this is not that point.
Yeah, that's very important. And that's why if you are listening to this program, I'd advise you to look at Tom's chart. He's got the S&P 500, and he's got QE1, QE2, 3, the election, and QE Infinity or space launch, whatever you want to call it. The amazing thing, Tom, is they're going to take their balance sheet, which was around $4 trillion. It could be $10 trillion at the end of the year, literally doubling their balance sheet and more in a single year. So, okay, let's go to the next chart, which is the advance decline line with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. What is this telling us?
This is a pretty famous indicator. It's watched by a lot of people. And for those who are not initiated, the advanced decline line is a cumulative indicator. It looks at every day at the difference between the number of stocks going up, the advances, and the number going down. And so if you run that on a cumulative basis, then if you have a positive day where there's positive breath, then the advanced decline line will go up. If you have a negative breath day, like we're having now with 2,800 declines and only 89 advances, then the advanced decline line goes down. So it's a different way of measuring what the stock market is doing than just looking at a price index. And it can be extremely useful when there is an important divergence between the two. Often we look at the advanced decline line to show us a bearish divergence where the advanced decline line is making a lower high while prices are making a higher high. We haven't had one of those for a while, but when they do show up historically, they are really important to listen to. We wish we would have gotten a bearish divergence ahead of the big COVID crash, because that's the kind of decline that a bearish divergence should be telling us about. But the fact that we didn't tells us that the COVID crash was not a liquidity event. It was an exogenous event caused by the government shutting down businesses and people panicking about it. Right now, we're seeing a higher high already in the advanced decline line, even though the Dow has not made one, the S&P has not made a higher high. So that is a bullish divergence. It says that there's plenty of liquidity to be able to lift all boats, and eventually we should see higher highs on the Dow also. For now, it says that liquidity is plentiful and the trend should continue higher.
All right. Well, let's move to the next chart, which I find rather interesting, and that's the near-month crude oil futures contract. You've got some key events: hedge fund squeeze, drone attack in Saudi Arabia, the killing of Suleiman, coronavirus, the Russia-Saudi price. You know, talk about a perfect storm. We had the coronavirus killing demand, and then at the same time, you had a price war between Russia and basically Saudi Arabia, and not to mention the fact that U.S. shale was really hitting record levels of production. So what is this telling you? And you've got it juxtaposed to a treasury yield index. So explain the meaning behind this chart.
Well, let me define some terms. The treasury yield index is the current yield to maturity on the most recently issued 30-year treasury bond. Whichever treasury bond that is, it was the most recently issued 30-year one. You measure the yield on that, and that's the treasury yield index. The fascinating part about this chart is that crude oil price movements tend to show up again about 3 weeks later in the movements of bond yields. So what you're getting here is a messenger telling you about the future of what interest rates are going to do. And it usually works really, really well, except when big geopolitical events or Federal Reserve or world governments put a thumb on the scale. So when you have a drone attack in Saudi Arabia that moves oil prices in a funny way, bond yields don't echo that. They'll echo the normal supply and demand movements of crude oil prices, but they don't echo the movements caused by exogenous events. And so we've been wondering, well, does the big coronavirus decline in crude oil and the Russia-Saudi blow up about oil production, is that going to be the same category of exogenous event that doesn't get echoed in bond yields, or is it normal? That's the part that's unknown. And what we have seen is the Treasury yield index has not matched the severity of the decline in crude oil prices, mostly because it can't. It's already down to one, or down into the ones. It bottomed just below 1%. And so you get to the point where you can't push yields down that much further. Now we've seen crude oil prices start to bounce back almost to 40, although they're falling quite a bit today, Thursday, as everything is falling. But the three-week move, the big up move in crude oil prices had not yet fully had its three-week echo in bond yields. So what I'm expecting to see is that bond yields should continue to follow the message of crude oil, should continue to work their way higher once we get past the extreme events of today, the 11th of June, as the stock market selling off and its bonds are rallying in response. Bond prices should go down as bond yields go higher to match the message of crude oil.
And as we're looking at this, people don't realize, I mean, we dipped all the way down to negative territory, which was an oddity due to an ETF. But when you take a look at where we got down to $10 on sort of a low, we're up almost 300%. So when you see something move that violently, both on the downside, is it typical, Tom, you would see it move violently in the opposite direction?
You're asking the right question. And that was an extreme case in back in April when one single oil futures contract went negative. It wasn't so much due to the oil ETF as it was the specifications for that contract stipulate delivery of the oil to Cushing, Oklahoma. Well, there wasn't any more storage available in Cushing, Oklahoma. And so when a contract expires and one party's still holding the bag and you got to take delivery and there's no place to take delivery to, then you start scrambling. And that's how that one contract, the May futures contract, went negative. When we look at a near month plot of of oil price, the oil futures prices, what we're looking at is what is the current month that's being traded. At the time that the May contract was going negative, it had already rolled off, and the June contract was the active contract at that month. So that's why this plot on my chart doesn't show the near month price going down below zero, because the June contract did not go below zero. It was just that one expiring May contract. This is kind of down into the weeds about how the oil market works, but the important message to get is that when you have a big uptrend in oil prices, for about 3 weeks later, you get a big uptrend in bond yields, and that's the message to take from it. Whether we'll see the same magnitude of move in bond yields that we saw in oil prices, that's a separate question. And the magnitude doesn't have to match, but the direction usually is correct. And if you get the direction right, the magnitude will take care of itself.
Yeah, just from a fundamental point of view, you've got U.S. production down about 2 million barrels. You got the Saudi deal down about 10 million barrels of production. And so there are a lot of forecasts, Tom, that by the time we get towards the end of the year, as we sort of normalize, and what's funny, you know, people may not be getting on airplanes, but people are driving. So staycations or road trips, RV sales are up, people are buying RVs. So demand is coming back into the market. So looking at this chart and just taking out your crystal ball, if assume that we don't get a major second wave of COVID as we head into the next flu season in September, October, would you expect oil prices to be higher as we head in to the end of the year based on this chart?
I do expect that, but not based on this chart. What this chart shows is that crude oil prices lead bond yields. So you're wondering, well, what leads crude oil prices? And it turns out that the movements of gold prices tend to show up again in crude oil prices about 20 months later. So crude oil prices bottomed right on schedule to match a bottom in gold prices 20 months earlier, but I think it was back in August 2018. And so gold has trended up since then, which says that after you wait for the lag to go by, oil prices should also trend up. So it's going to be a more encouraging time for people that are in the oil industry in the months ahead than it has been in the first part of 2020 for sure.
Well, it'll be interesting because if I'm looking at this chart, crude prices are up about 300%. As a result, as you show in your chart, we're seeing a rise in bond yields. It'll be interesting if crude continues to rise as demand comes back into the market, and along with it, bond yields, but also inflation. So you start to see oil prices rise, gold prices rise. It will be interesting, Tom, to see what the Fed does, because basically on this week's FOMC meeting, they basically said, we have no idea about they are basically going to be printing money and there's no insight. In other words, they're not giving us a date. In fact, they kind of gave us a date that they said, we're going to be doing this for the next couple of years, keeping interest rates at zero. And if you look at the magnitude of the money that's coming into this market, they're going to more than double their balance sheet in a year. It would be interesting, Tom, once inflation starts to rise, what the Fed does.
And interesting also that the U.S. Treasury is printing a bunch of debt that the Fed is buying. And so we as taxpayers and our grandchildren are all going to be having to deal with a whole bunch more debt that's on the government's books. And that debt has to pay interest. Well, the interest rate is zero on the short-term debt right now, and it's very low in the long-term. But if inflation comes in, then the bond market's not going to accept getting low interest rates in an inflationary environment. No matter what the Fed thinks it can do or wants to do, if inflation comes back, then that's going to be a big risk factor. And I am glad I'm not in charge of having to clean that up, because it's going to be a big mess and it's going to be unpleasant for a long time. There's a 60-year cycle in long-term bond yields, which is what we're talking about here with the Treasury Yield Index. There's a 60-year cycle, and we are now in the upward phase of that, headed toward a top due in 2040. And this 60-year cycle exists in the entirety of the history of interest rates, as far back as anybody has been able to compile them back to the 1700s in any kind of reliable way. And it's actually tied to climate. There is the same 60-year cycle. It shows up in interest rates, shows up in a lot of the climate data for global average temperatures. And so the linkage between interest rates and climate is agricultural. When you have a cooling period, which we're supposed to be having now and so far have not really gotten started, a cooling period for global average temperatures tends to have a depressing effect on agricultural output, which makes food prices go higher and makes inflation of other things generally go higher. And so the two are coupled together pretty well over the really long term, not from day to day or week to week, but over the really long term. So as we have this cooling period unfold between now and about 2040 when it's due to end, we should have a rising period for interest rates that's going to be really tough for the Fed and the Treasury to fight against. And once again, I'm going to repeat, I'm glad I'm not in charge of having to solve that problem.
You know, Tom, what do you think we see the bond vigilantes? I started my career at the end of the 70s, early 80s. When the bond vigilantes, anytime you saw the money supply figures go up, the Fed was printing money, you would just have the bond vigilantes show up and drive interest rates up higher. I mean, if you take a look at the deficits that we're running now, if you take a look at the amount of money the Fed is backstopping almost every single asset class on the planet, including currency swaps, the bond vigilantes have been relatively quiet.
Yeah. And what the Fed is doing and what the Treasury is doing is arguably criminal, and it's going to have a horrible negative effect on us in the future. But for the moment, it's bullish for stock prices. So we have to separate in our heads the difference between whether something's a good idea or whether it should ever be done and whether it's bullish. And right now we're in one of those horrible situations where the Fed and the Treasury are doing awful things that are going to harm us in a really long-term way. But it's terribly bullish for stock prices while they're doing it.
And speaking of commodities, I want to go and end with gold. As you take a look at gold, the Fed is printing money like crazy. The government is spending money like crazy. I can't help but think that this is very bullish for gold long term. What's your take on gold here?
You are citing excellent logic that should work that way, where if the amount of gold is on the planet does not change, and last I checked, it doesn't change very fast, but the amount of money goes up, well, what a price is, that's the ratio of money to stuff. So if you have more money and the same amount of stuff, you're going to see higher prices. That's how it should work. That's how inflation should work for everything. But that's not actually how it does work in the case of gold, which is fascinating. The correlation between big surges in money supply, like M2, and the stock market having big surges, that's a very good correlation. But the correlation between gold prices and money supply is not as good, which is defies the excellent logic that you were citing. It should work that way. I don't have a good explanation for exactly why it doesn't work that way. Everybody thinks it should work that way, and they're piling money like mad into GLD and IAU, which are the two largest of the gold bullion ETFs, even though gold prices are not really going up very much. They've just been chopping sideways between 1700 and 1750. Normally, people will pour money into GLD and IAU when gold is going up, and they'll pull money out of it when it's going down. And that's normal. You know, there's nothing like an uptrend to make people bullish and want to invest. There's nothing like a downtrend to make them flee. What we're seeing now, though, is different. We're seeing people pouring money into GLD and IAU in the absence of an uptrend to explain it. And so what that tells you is you are seeing pure sentiment, not price-induced sentiment, but pure sentiment. People just think that gold should go up, and so they're acting on that, even though gold doesn't have to obey what we think. And amazingly, it's not. In spite of all the money printing, gold is not going anywhere. There's an eight-year cycle in gold prices that usually involves five down years and then three up years. That cycle topped last year, and so now we're due for a five-year down cycle in gold, irrespective of what the Fed is doing. And so that's going to have a depressing effect on gold, and it's going to keep that excellent logic you cited from working as well as it maybe should have.
All right, one final question. So given what we're seeing here, we know the Fed is printing money. We know that's very positive. When QE comes out, the stock market goes up. When they stop QE, the stock market goes down. So given the fact that this is QE on steroids, like double steroids, what would you be doing?
Well, I'd be not fighting the Fed. We're bullish. We're fully invested. In fact, I added today into the sell-off for our managed account program, bought some more NASDAQ 100 mutual fund with that program. And I'm expecting that the brief sell-off is going to exhaust itself and rebound. It's going to be a long uptrend because the Fed says so, and the Fed has the power to make that happen. At the point that the Fed starts to change its mind, then you need to worry a lot. But this is not that point.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them about your website and what they're going to find there.
Our website is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of the name, the McClellan Oscillator, which is an indicator that my parents developed, Sherman and Marion McClellan. You go to mcoscillator.com and you can find out about our twice a month newsletter and our daily edition. You can sign up for our free weekly chart and focus articles sent by email. Don't do advertising on our website. We don't have a mailing list to blast you with offers or anything. We don't spam you in any way. It's just a way to get more people acquainted with the indicators that we use, and maybe you'll find it interesting and want to subscribe to our newsletter.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, thanks so much for coming on the program. Take care, and we'll talk again.
Be well, Jim.
Ed Yardeni joined FS Insider this week to give an update on his market and economic outlook, and says that we are much more prepared for a surge in COVID infections this time around. He does not think that we are going to see widespread lockdowns, and that central bankers, in coordination with the U.S. government, are now definitely implementing modern monetary theory by printing money and throwing caution to the wind.
So far, over the past 10 years, we've basically been doing sort of a mini version of MMT. I mean, it didn't seem like it at the time. It was large numbers, but we saw the Treasury running large deficits, and a lot of those deficits were partially funded by what was called quantitative easing programs by the Fed. So now all we're doing is we're doing it on steroids. We're doing it in massive size, and now because of the virus, we're just throwing caution to the wind and saying, let's just do it as long as we can get away with it.
Ed Yardeni also makes some very stark and revealing comments, considering that he used to work not only for the Federal Reserve, but also for the U.S. Treasury. To listen to this full interview, in addition to all of our interviews airing 3 days during the week on FS Insider, through our website, or through a podcast app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Recently, the dollar's been going down, gold has been going up, along with stocks. Will this trend continue? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is Mark Chandler from Bannockburn. Mark, let's talk about the dollar. It sort of peaked at the beginning of the March, and boy, it's come down substantially, and along with it, gold has gone up. Although gold is going sideways, they typically go in opposite directions. So why don't we begin with the dollar and gold? And I'd like to get your take here.
Sure. So thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. So the first place I'd think about is that what happened. I mean, so in the big picture, I say that the dollar had been strong last year, and many people expected it to extend its gains this year. I had thought that we are finishing up what seems to be the third big dollar rally since the U.S. left Bretton Woods. And I was thinking that dollar rally that I had anticipated when it began was rolling over. And then we got hit with this COVID crisis, and the dollar wobbled a little bit. But as you said, it had been trending higher until the late March or so. But I think that first phase of the dollar's move down was just the market simply removing the fear that we saw in March of like the end of days. I mean, with the stock market, the volatility, ranges in the currencies, it just looked like the market had broken down. Policymakers, fiscal policy, monetary policy came to the rescue, stabilized the capital markets, said that they were going to underwrite good parts of the high-income economies, and we saw the dollar sort of adjust a bit lower, but it hadn't really turned. And to me, what happened is it really turned in the middle of May, when I think that my longer-term outlook for the dollar super cycle to be coming to an end sort of, I think, began exerting itself. And I think this is really the common theme throughout all the capital markets right now. And that is that officials have just pumped so much liquidity into the system. Business investment is very weak. Consumption remains weak. All this liquidity is driving up the demand for risk assets. And as people demand risk assets, stock market, you saw what happened on the June 8th, the S&Ps turned higher for the year, joining the NASDAQ, which is up roughly 10% for the year. Liquidity is lifting all ships, whether the ships are sustainable or not, it's a different story, but it's rising all ships. And I think that this is what's turning the dollar. We see this first in some of the high beta currencies, like the Australian dollar, the Canadian dollar, the Mexican peso and Brazilian real. These two currencies were the hardest hit in the first part of the year, and they were the strongest currencies in the world in May. And this is just spilling over. And I think the euro is a big beneficiary of it as well, because there's a big short position against the euro.
So as you look at this, it's been said that it's sort of like a Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. You have liquidity, which is driving all these asset classes, the risk trade, and then you have the real economy. The two are just miles apart in terms of what is actually going on. As you mentioned, consumption is weak. I mean, who's going to go out to the malls, and especially with riots? You have people, the savings rate is probably at the highest level we've seen. Businesses aren't sure what to do to invest with, you know, what's this post-COVID world going to look like? So we have these two different dichotomies between the economy and the markets. But how long does this go? I mean, is there enough liquidity when you're talking trillions and trillions of dollars? Us, the ECB, the Bank of China, the Bank of Japan. How long will this continue?
Yeah, I think that's like a question everybody has. And it reminds me of this cartoon I saw. It had a guy was carrying a sign that said, "The end is nigh, the end is nigh." And another person says to him, "Why are you so optimistic? This could last forever." And so I take from that just the idea that where is all this going to go? What's going to happen? And I think a lot of people are concerned about the long-term sustainability of this. But, you know, I think that the decoupling of Wall Street from Main Street is like an overtold story. It happens. Think about where we were before we became aware of COVID. Early February, stock market is making record high, and yet the earnings didn't really justify it, right? The valuations are very stretched. So I think it's been a long time since Wall Street, that is the stock market, really reflected the way the average person in America lives. I know that this debt level is concerning. I know the CBO is projecting an 18% budget deficit this year.
Wow.
18%. And that's before this bill before Congress that they're debating, which I'm sure is going to be implemented next month. The Republicans are offering $1 trillion. The House had passed a version of $2 trillion more dollars. So even what we have for the budget deficit this year is probably going to be bigger rather than smaller. On the other hand, you say, how long can it go? I mean, you know, as we're sitting here today, the Germans can borrow 30-year money, the German government, for negative rates. That is to say, the yield in Germany out 30 years is negative. Japan has negative interest rates. We're looking at something like $12 trillion worth of negative yielding bonds in the world. And so the U.S. pays today about 85 basis points to borrow 10-year money. Is it sustainable? As long as, this sounds very American, but I'm sorry if it's just too like parochial, but the idea is that as long as you can service your debt, so what? Some people have household debt for their whole life, whether it's a mortgage, credit cards, auto debt. The problem is not so much debt in a perspective, but can you service it? And I think there's no doubt that the U.S. can service its debt.
So as long as we can make those payments, and quite honestly, I mean, the government can take on debt and the Fed could simply just print and monetize it. Mark, let's talk about the last time we went through this cycle, and that was between the 2007 and 2009 cycle. We were taking on debt, but a lot of the money that the Fed printed basically remained on the Fed's balance sheet. I wonder if you might contrast what the implications are. This time around, instead of staying on the Fed's balance sheet, the government is using fiscal policy, and it doesn't seem to be an end in sight. At least right now, the Fed is calling for more of it. But the government is spending money, which is putting money into the economy, and then the Fed is coming behind that and simply monetizing it. They're buying treasuries.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what they've done. You know, at the peak of the cycle, the peak of the crisis, I should say, back in late March and early April, the Fed was buying $75 billion a day of U.S. Treasury bonds. This week, it's going to be buying $4 billion a day, down from $75 billion. So it's true, the Fed's balance sheet is still expanding quite rapidly, but not so much anymore with treasuries, but a lot of other stuff, which of course, almost by definition, will have a lower quality. And so here's how I kind of think about the deficit and and what's going on. During the 2008-2009 great financial crisis, say that the economy went from peak to trough by about 5%. And the government spent the deficit at its peak was about 10% of GDP. So what's happened this year, we're going to find out. I mean, it's still not clear yet, of course, how bad the economy has been performing here in the second quarter. But the Atlanta Fed, which has this GDP tracker, says that its model suggests the economy may be contracting at a 50%, actually a little bit more than a 50% annualized rate. So the economy is contracting much steeper than it did in the 08-09 financial crisis, and yet the budget deficit is only doubling. Mm. So in some ways, the budget deficit is big because we've been hit with this big blow. And now, is it proportionate? Is it going to be enough to lift us? And I think that the first hurdle will be that, like in 08-09, there's some people who argue, like Paul Krugman, that we took the punch bowl back too early. So where's the first punch bowl now? It's at the end of July. At the end of July, that extra $600 a week unemployment insurance compensation is set to expire. And if Congress does not renew that, what's going to happen? I think that's the first test between, like, the people who saw that the jobs data looked better than expected, think that this government's gone too far. Where is the first stand? Where is going to be the first skirmish? And what seems to be going to be a protracted struggle? End of July, this extra $600 a week payment goes away unless it's renewed. And there, I think, is where the first skirmish between these two powerful forces will fight it out.
You know, another pivot point, which basically just got extended, is you had the PPP plan, which basically gave money to businesses to keep their employees employed so that when the economy did reopen, they wouldn't have to find new employees and retrain them. Now, that got extended to 24 weeks because they realized a lot of these large state governors were keeping their economies closed. So what do you do with employees you have on the payroll, but your economy is shut down? What do you do? So they extended, they recognized that problem because a lot of these big state governors still haven't fully opened. And, you know, what do you do with your employees? So isn't that another pivot point? Now, it got extended to 24 weeks, but, you know, some have suggested we could have another unemployment wave when this expires if economies aren't functioning. I mean, what happens, for example, Mark, if the flu season starts in October and we get a second wave of the virus? What happens then?
Yeah, it's like, I think this is why it's such a difficult time for businesses and for investors. You raise like a lot of important elements of the uncertain future that we have, and these like many of these key unknowns. And so, because of the unknown, it's really a question. Really, so rather than like try to deny the unknown, I think that it's like officials are trying to wrestle with what's the best course of policy given this high degree of uncertainty. And so, it's a question of like first, priorities, given the kind of economic hit that we're going through and given these uncertainties, should we be taking our foot off the accelerator, tapping the brake, or do we still go like full throttle until we see if we get convincing signs of something positive? And I think this is where the fight is over.
And isn't this being reflected? I mean, if you look at the uncertainty in the economy right now, you talked about consumption. If you're turning on your TV and watching the riots and looting, you're probably not going to take your stimulus check and say, hey, sweetheart, let's go to the mall and shop this weekend. You have that. But if you take a look at the market itself, Mark, you've got consumer staples, utilities, healthcare, typically your defensive sectors of the market doing well, plus technology. Because what are we finding in this? Technology. I mean, our whole office has been functioning at home because of technology. So technology is doing very well along with consumer staples and other defensive type sectors of the economy. Once again, almost like a bifurcated market.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're going to see. This is why I think next week, beginning with the 15th, it could be one of the most important weeks that we have in this quarter, in the next couple of months, because of what's going to happen. You got an EU summit that's going to decide about their own joint fiscal policy. You've got a big loan facility that the ECB is going to have that's going to could be making these three-year loans at minus 100 basis points. And in the U.S., we're going to see the May retail sales number. Remember, in April, it was down almost 16.5%. So a big hit in April, but it looks like the recovery is already taking some hold. I think that the consensus or the median forecast is for almost an 8% increase in May of retail sales. And the same kind of story in industrial production, 11% loss in April. And it looks like it's stabilized, came back a little bit, maybe a 3% gain, 2.5 to 3% gain in industrial output. And then we're going to get the June Empire State Survey and Philly Fed surveys, first indicators outside of those weekly jobless claims for how the economy is doing in June. And so my guess is that the recovery is already beginning, and now it's going to be how fast it is and how is it disappointing. And to your point about these uncertainties, that the ultimate trajectory of the economy is still highly dependent on the progress against the pathogen.
So is it possible, you know, economists have been trying to come up with a letter to describe what this recovery is going to look like, V-shaped, L-shaped, W-shaped, you know, who knows what letters they'll come up with. But is it possible, and let me just put this out hypothetically, the government is coming up with another stimulus, whether it's going to be $1 trillion like the Republicans want in the Senate or $3 trillion as passed in the House. So you throw another trillion in this. Is it possible, Mark, if we get to the fall and let's say we don't get a second wave, all this money that's sitting in cash, and let's say we're not in a lockdown mode anymore, that people begin to feel more confident, maybe they feel better that they're not at risk, and then all of a sudden they start spending.
That'd be a great story ending for 2020. And I think that to your point, part of what we saw recently, of course, is that income levels have gone up, even though consumption's fallen. And this is the government's, unintended boost in savings by locking people up in their houses and keeping the stores closed. So, of course, we are going to see some pent-up consumption. I'm not quite into the V camp for the bottom, but you know what I've sort of been more mulling over is a K-shaped. And that is some people who had good preconditions, some countries with good preconditions, they will do better. Some people, companies, countries with poor preconditions. And so that's why I kind of think the K-shape as a growing divergence. For example, in Europe, Germany had a fiscal balance, small surplus. So they're in a position to spend a lot of money to address this issue fiscally as well. For the first time in many different downturns, Germany is really opening up its purse strings. Germany, I'm afraid, is going to be can spend more money than the other European countries, and there'll be going to be divergence between Germany again and the periphery. And that's why importance of coordinated policy. You see what's happening in the United States. I think that the keeping people locked up, there's going to be like a pent up. But I think that the divergence of income and wealth, which I really like, life opportunities in the U.S. is boiling over. And this is what we're seeing now is just a tip of it. I'm not sure that this is going to be sustainable for any long period of time. So I don't think this is really a big curb on consumption. But I do think that there's going to be greater divergence. And that's going to be harder for a society that already has low levels of social trust to deal with.
Yeah, because one of the issues that we've seen throughout the COVID crisis is the healthcare officials seem to change their mind every 2 weeks. You know, first it was no mask, then it was only masks for people with COVID, then it was everybody with masks. Now it's masks you need to wash your hands after putting on the mask. And they keep changing it. It's like you don't know what the hell to believe anymore. And the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is a loss of trust in leadership, in authority, whether it's the healthcare officials that keep changing their mind, whether it's what we're seeing socially. And the other thing, Mark, it reminds me of the Great Depression, where what happened during the Great Depression and what happened in World War II impacted an entire generation. I can't think, at least in my lifetime or probably yours, an event or a series of events as we've seen since the beginning of this year, how that will not impact people psychologically going forward.
Oh, yeah. When you think that we had an impeachment trial, you think that we, you know, this the COVID, I think this is the real thing. You know, we've been, what amazes me is sort of like a Barbara Tuchman's book about the March to Folly. Senior policymakers knew about that the threat of a pandemic. They were told this from different national intelligence, from different channels. Had the pandemic as one of the big risks. And the amazing thing, I think, is how unprepared we were for it. And I think that I think you're right. This is one of those moments that define the before and after. Mm. I think that many people are still wrestling with how powerful of a force this has been. Will it change the trajectory of events? Or will it more accelerate those kind of tendencies that were already in place, like economic nationalism? I mean, it makes no sense, it seems to me. And I was talking about this partly because of a book I read called The China RX, that even before this COVID problem, that the U.S. was importing 95% of our penicillin from China. And it seemed to me to make no sense. And from China's point of view, it makes no sense that they are beholden to the U.S. duopoly on mobile operating systems, OIS and Android. So I had anticipated divergence, and for me, the COVID is just accelerating that divergence. I had thought the dollar was going to turn lower, and the euro fell to new lows late March, and the same day the euro bottomed, S&P's bottomed. And so so I think that might accelerate that movement as well, as far as the broader turn of the dollar.
Yeah, I just see a lot of these trends that were in place. Number one, online shopping is going to be more prevalent now with COVID. I mean, just take a look at what's happened to Amazon. So look what the number of retailers that keep filing for bankruptcy. And then the second thing I think you're going to see is the trouble in the commercial real estate market, because companies are finding, hey, wait a minute, we can get by with less space with teleworking. So that's a trend I see going forward. And I just think that consumers, when you get hit by a series of shockwaves, I mean, as you mentioned, we started out with impeachment, then we had COVID, now we have rioting and looting, and we're not even through the first half of the year yet.
This is one of those years. I mean, it's true. And I think that it's still so startling to see the stock market here, even though we're having a little bit of a pullback today, there's still an underlying firmness to it. It's just amazing that we're, you know, that it's sort of like asking, besides that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like to play?
So, Mark, given these circumstances, as an investor, what are you advising people to do?
Yeah, so I'll tell you what I'm doing with my own personal account, and that is I've tried to ride out this, and I've begun selling some calls against some of my existing equity positions that I have some money in, just as a little bit of protection, because I'm even though I can understand how it's liquidity driven, I am nervous at these levels without some more support from news, and I think news streams still can get worse. So I'm just being cautious. I still think that the for most of us investors, that dollar cost averaging, whether it's like the money every week from our paychecks under our 401k, we have to keep doing that, both when the stock market looks horrible, like it did in March and part of April, and when it looks at these levels, because the whole it's a very dollar cost averaging, a very disciplined approach, and you got to do it at high prices as well as low prices.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Mark, if our listeners would like to follow you, and also you've written several books, could you mention them briefly and how they can follow your work?
Sure. So I'm on the social media. I have a blog called Mark to Market. That's Mark with a C. I have something up there almost every day, broad macro commentary. I'm on Twitter at Mark Making Sense, and I try to contribute there as well. I as you mentioned, I have two books. One is just an overview of the foreign exchange market after about 20 years of experience on Wall Street. I wrote a book called Making Sense of the Dollar. That was published by Bloomberg Press. And then some ideas I've been working with since I got out of graduate school, where I had a master's in American history. I found this guy, Charles Conant, who was an advisor to U.S. presidents, who I thought had a very modern interpretation of what's happening. And I used him to like look at what's happened here in sort of, say, since the 1980s. And so that book's called Political Economy of Tomorrow. And that's both of them are available electronic on the electronic bookstores. But yes, please. And I'm always available. If people want to reach out to me on one of these social media platforms, happy to exchange views.
All right, Mark. Well, listen, stay safe and come back again.
Good luck to everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Joining us on the show today is the Chief Investment Officer for Financial Sense Wealth Management,
Chris Poplava. Chris, let's talk about the big decline that we saw in the market this week and some of the items that are rattling investors. What are your thoughts on the decline and what is the big picture takeaway as you see it?
If you look at the market, we were actually getting pretty euphoric. I mean, if you look at sentiment data, like put call option data, it was starting to show a lot of complacency. Another thing that's kind of becoming a hot topic item is the amount of Robinhood accounts. That's the free online, free trading brokerage account platform. And they were seeing a surge in new accounts that were opening there, almost akin to, I think, what we saw in China back in 2015. If you looked at and watched the number of brokerage accounts being opened in China when they were going through their bubble. And, you know, with that being said, you know, I think there's a lot of hot money that's come into the market, pushing things higher. But this decline, while it's painful, you know, overall, it's healthy. You never want to see the market go straight up because oftentimes it will then go straight down. I am surprised a little bit by the magnitude of the decline. I was expecting some kind of a pullback and some sideways action in the market, but not as dramatic as we're seeing today. I think with just still dealing with the pandemic, there's a lot of angst in the market, and I think people are very quick to get in and get out. So I think volatility is here to stay. Doesn't matter what market, equities, fixed income, currency. I think we're going to see elevated levels of volatility going forward.
This week, we actually spoke with Ed Yardeni on our FS Insider program. He's the president and chief investment strategist at Yardeni Research. He previously worked at the New York Fed, and then he was also at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors and also the U.S. Treasury. One thing that he said is that we have definitively crossed into modern monetary theory at this point, and that's coming from an ex-Fed U.S. Treasury official, if you want to call him that. So he says, you know, at this point, the Fed, the U.S. government, they're now joined at the hip and they are giving, he called it free money theory, not necessarily modern monetary theory, but free money to businesses and to individuals. And so the Fed is really backstopping the markets at this point, which is one reason why he didn't think that we're going to revisit the lows. I know that that's something that we've been discussing with you on the program over the past, you know, month or so. Is that you didn't think that we would retest the March 23rd lows. Are you still of that opinion?
I am. And one of the things that I did, and if you go to our website, you might have seen on some of the articles that I've written, is I took a look at every bear market since World War II. And I wanted to delineate new bull markets from dead cat bear market bounces. And one of the criteria I used in the study was to have the requirement that you do go through an official bear market where you've fallen at least 20%. And then what happens after when you've at least recovered half of that decline? And what we found of the 12 bear markets, there were 11 out of the 12 did not retest the lows, and it was actually the low. After World War II, I think the late 40s, we did see a revisit of the lows and actually slight undercut. But outside of that, that was the only case. And when we look at the markets in which the market recovers at least 61.8% of the retracement, a common retracement number that people use, there was no exception. The bottom was in and there was no revisit of the lows. And we've gone well beyond the 50% and even the 61.8% retracement level. But what I did is I wanted to see, okay, you know, after we get past that level, if we don't revisit the lows, can we still expect, some significant corrections? And so what I did is I took all of those cases and looked at the average path, the best case and worst case, and then plotted that from the starting point of the 50% retracement to see how we're acting. And literally from that level, which was in mid-April when we had the 50% retracement, all the way through, I would say, late May, we were literally hugging a little bit above and a little bit below the average path of prior bull markets. But beginning in late May, going into the early part of this year, I'm sorry, the early part of this month, the market really took off. And at one point, a couple days ago, we were actually above the best case that we have seen of all the other prior bear market bottoms. So, you know, for the market to come back, that would actually just put us at about the average path. If we follow the average path, then we would be looking at around 3,000 on the S&P. So about another 100 points lower, we would still be at the average path of the prior bull markets since World War II. So I always think studying history, it really helps put things into context as the noise from the news day to day can really shake you. You know, sometimes you have to step away and rather than looking at the news stories of the day, you know, look at the historical precedents that we've seen. And from what I could see, even the worst case scenario after the S&P retraced half of its bear market, we would be roughly around, I think the worst case scenario would be around 2,600 on the S&P. So, you know, if we maintain above 2,600, we still would not be the worst case scenario. We would still be in the realm of prior precedent. So, you know, for me, I think that kind of helps to frame context that things were getting a little bit frothy, just like, at, you know, the extreme in March when the markets were selling off precipitously. You know, I was telling clients, if the Dow continues to fall like this, it's going to be at zero in a matter of weeks. And we know that's not possible. And likewise, if the S&P and the NASDAQ and the Dow continue to rally like this, I mean, we're going to be talking Dow 50,000, you know, by the end of the year. So we can't go up, you know, straight up and straight down. So this is healthy. But I will say I'm shocked by the speed of the decline today. And that just to me shows that this is a very trigger happy market in which, you know, we can rise and fall very rapidly as people move from fear and greed rapidly. But overall, I do think that, you know, things are still constructive and, you know, we're still maintaining a bullish outlook.
Now, Chris, I know that you actually do follow the COVID infection data pretty closely. This was something that you were doing even in the lead up to the big correction that we saw in March. You were following that data very closely, and it was one reason why you were as concerned as you were that we would see a lot of collateral damage when it comes to the economy and the markets. And you were rightly getting defensive into the market drawdown that we saw then. What are your thoughts now when we look at the infection data? Obviously, the big thing that everyone is citing right now, if you look at the news headlines for this week's decline, was the fact that we are starting to see a surge in cases. Intensive care units are now starting to get filled back up with people that have respiratory problems. And so clearly the market is reacting to a worry for further lockdowns and then another cessation of economic activity. I think if we were to see anything along the lines of what we saw in March with the initial lockdowns, then we would be probably looking at a depression. The thinking is that we're not going to be doing that again, at least to the extent that we did the first time, and it'll be a more nuanced and data-based approach, which is what we all hope to see take place. That being said, what are your thoughts on the current surge and how this translates to, you know, what you're doing for clients at Financial Sense Wealth Management in managing risk?
One of the things I was looking for, you know, with all these demonstrations and obviously protesters in very close proximity, was thinking that we would probably see a spike in cases. That coupled with economies reopening, that was something that I was worried about. And clearly, you know, that's occurring right now. It's not universal. If you look at states like Connecticut, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, you know, they continue to see their daily growth decline. They've improved. Other states like Hawaii, Montana, Vermont, West Virginia, Wyoming, they're also showing improving trends. But the concern is the states that are not. In Arizona, for example, Arizona has really been spiking of late. Alaska has seen a huge surge. Alabama continues to rise. Arkansas, California continues to see its daily growth pick up. So there's plenty of states that are moving in the wrong direction. And it clearly is something we have to watch, because if we see the number of cases begin to rise again and overwhelm the system, the healthcare system, then we might be looking at another shutdown. And if you think back to when this first occurred in the spring, you know, there's a lot of industries that were hurt. But, you know, the impact could be pretty significant in the summer if we see during prime travel season with school being out, moving back towards a lockdown. It would definitely be something to keep an eye on.
Anything that you're looking at, aside from COVID, of course, as we discussed, that is keeping you from a more bearish posture or moving clients to a lower risk position to the stock market? Because again, we do currently have that neutral posture in place. So what is it that you're also looking at is maintaining this neutral position that we have right now?
You are correct. We do have a neutral stance towards the stock market. We're slightly underweight fixed income at the expense of commodities. If you look at the amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus that is being applied, from my vantage point, I think we're going to see the US dollar weaken over the coming year. And as protection against that currency debasement, we have moved into precious metals, first into gold, and then more recently into silver. So the allocation in our accounts, we have shifted by underweighting fixed income, where there's virtually no yield, into commodities, where we're basically hedging against future current debasement. But we are neutral. And as you mentioned, you know, there's sometimes you want to basically, you know, have things to be 100% invested. And as I mentioned, you know, with you 2 weeks ago, we're not. And the reason for that is a massive amount of uncertainty. You know, we haven't experienced anything like this ever before, not since the 1918 Spanish flu. So clearly, there's a lot of warranted conservatism around that. But at the same time, we also have the reaction to this in terms of monetary and fiscal authorities, unlike anything we have ever seen. You know, for example, the U.S. Fed is on the path of doubling its balance sheet in just the next 1 or 2 months here. The Fed now has a balance sheet greater than $7 trillion. It is staggering where literally just going back to September of last year, the Fed's balance sheet was under $4 trillion as it was reducing its balance sheet until last September when it began to expand it once more. But it's not just the Fed's balance sheet. If you look at the amount of money that is in money markets, we are nearing $5 trillion in money market assets. And when you look at that plus other categories, like if you look at the amount sitting in commercial bank deposits, that has surged. And we're seeing things like we haven't seen before. For example, in the last 6 months, the amount of growth in money market assets has gone up by more than 30%. Even at the peak of the financial crisis in 2007 through 2009, never had we seen the surge in money markets by more than 30% over a six-month time frame. And the data that we have goes back to the late 1980s. We have never seen anything like this. Even further, we've got data on commercial bank deposits going back to the early 70s. And at no time in history have we ever seen a vertical spike in the amount of deposits sitting at banks. And currently, over the last 6 months, commercial bank deposits have grown by 16%. So there's a massive amount of money on the sidelines. The Fed has massively expanded its balance sheet. And so from my vantage point, when you've got all of that money sitting earning 0%, we know investors aren't going to sit in cash forever. You can't retire on 0% interest rates. You can't live on that. And for that reason, you know, that money will come back. We don't know where, obviously, it could go into other assets, real estate, and so forth. But I do feel that there is somewhat of a limited downside to the market with all of that money on the sidelines. If that money was not there, sure, we could have more downside as investors raise cash. But I think there's a lot of people who raise cash and have not gotten in. So if you are an investor who sold near the bottom, you've actually, you know, probably beating yourself up over the last several months. And if the market begins to pull in here, you know, the Dow a couple more thousand points or S&P a couple hundred points, you're probably looking at an entry point. And the other thing too that we've seen, the Fed has really very little tolerance to any kind of market weakness. Essentially, whatever market is declining, the Fed's going to start going in there. I mean, we went from treasuries and mortgage-backed securities this time around to municipals, to investment-grade corporate bonds, and even junk-grade corporate bonds. So I do think the Fed is going to limit things. And as they stated this week, they're keeping interest rates locked at zero, and their forecast is through 22. So we've got years of 0% interest rates, and I have a hard time believing all that money is going to be sitting on the sidelines.
Chris, as we've discussed with you in prior Smart Macro segments, there's a number of different things that you have on your dashboard that you watch for warning signs on the trend of the market, whether or not that primary trend is in danger of breaking. One big topic that we continue to discuss is the credit markets, whether or not the credit markets are confirming. There's also a large number of technical breadth measures that we can also look to as well. Any warning signs currently when we think about the big decline that we saw in the stock market this week?
No, you know, heading into the recent peak, I was looking at the credit markets, and from the junkiest of junk, you know, looking at triple C rated bonds, those spreads were improving relative to risk-free treasuries. And then, you know, other parts of the junk bond market, the double Bs, the single Bs, they were in even the investment grade corporate bond market. Everything was showing improvement. It was confirming what we were seeing in terms of the improvement of the stock market. And the concern I would have is if it was being, the market was being led by fewer and fewer stocks, you know, for example, just the tech sector, the big tech giants. But that's not what we were seeing. If anything, we were seeing the rally begin to broaden out, which is encouraging to other sectors. You know, obviously the most recent being the cyclical sectors like energy, and does also not sending any warning sign. So, you know, when I look at the breadth, I look at a couple of measures, and one of the ones I like is looking at new highs and new lows to see, do we see improvement? Were there any warning signs that participation was beginning to wane? And we weren't seeing that. You know, as recently as last week, If you look at the amount of the S&P 500 stocks that were hitting three-month new highs, we reached over 60% of the 500 stocks in S&P. We were hitting three-month new highs. That was the highest level we had seen going all the way back to 2011 when Ben Bernanke was launching QE2. So again, a lot of participation on the upside, which is healthy. You always worry when it's, you know, the market's being led by only a handful of companies. And that describes 2018. Before the big decline in 2018, the fourth quarter, it really was the FANG stocks that were holding the market up. But absent that, you know, there were a lot of stocks that were already in bear markets. And that is not the case right now. We actually have a lot of confirmation. If anything, I think we were getting very overheated, very overbought. So seeing a market pullback was to be expected. Obviously not the size of the move that we're seeing, a huge down day today in the Dow. That to me is surprising. Not that we're pulling back here, but the speed of which this is happening. But again, you know, prior to this week, there really, from what I could see, was no warning sign other than some complacency in the market. So overall, I still think heading into this, things were positive and improving. But again, the big wild card's the COVID-19, and just seeing how that plays out here and keeping an eye on that.
So in sum, Chris, it sounds like, as you said, the big decline that we saw in the market this week was in large part a function of the fact that we saw too much complacency enter into the market. That was something that we brought up 2 weeks ago, how we were starting to see signs, early signs of complacency. From that time till now, the markets were just heading straight up. So the markets were getting ahead of themselves. However, as you said, when you're looking at the credit markets, when you're looking at breadth measures, no major warning signs at this point under the surface to say that the market is in danger of retesting the lows or seeing a major turnaround at this point. But again, the big caveat to all of that is what's going to happen with COVID data, COVID infection rates going forward, and how various governors respond by either locking down or taking a more nuanced approach. And again, we have currently a neutral position on the stock market, underweight fixed income with a slight exposure to commodities. With that said, what would be the best way for our listeners to discuss with you any of our investment services or about your investment outlook and what you are doing currently at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
They can call me at 888-486-3939, or they can send me an email at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour and our Smart Macro segment with Chris Paplava. Again, if you'd like to give him a call to discuss his investment outlook or to speak with any of our financial advisors, you can do so by giving us a call at 888-486-3939. And also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour and the wide range of guest experts, investment strategists, and book authors that we speak with on a regular basis. Some of the top thinkers in the industry covering business, finance, economics, and societal trends. Again, we do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.